No, all that first part was heresy. That's why I didn't record it. All right. Verse 11. Let's pick up there.
I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. And I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding.
Now think about this. Nehemiah has never been to Jerusalem, more than likely. We don't know for sure, but more than likely, he's never seen this place. God's given him a vision, but he's never even seen the place. He's going to go rebuild a wall. What is he doing at this point? Yeah, he's going on a scouting trip, quietly, right? He's counting the cost. What's going on? How bad is this? He's thinking, holy cow. Like, what did I get myself into? We find out, and we know from the destruction of the temple, this place is a wreck. Like, everything was destroyed. So I would imagine he's probably swallowing hard at this point, going, this is a big undertaking. You know, maybe I bit off more than I can chew, right? But he's looking at it. He's walking around. He tells nobody about it. Verse 13, he even goes out at night just so that nobody sees him. And he's just investigating. He's taking notes. He's thinking about what it is that he must be done. And we find out he's undaunted. Man, he is. He's committed to this. He's all in. He inspects the walls in verse 13, all the gates that were broken down, and he's literally putting a plan together. And he's taking this vision, this idea, and he's putting shoe leather on it. This is what it's going to take. This is how much rock. This is how much timber. This is how many people we're going to need. This is how long the wall is. Oh my gosh, how are we going to do this? There's one of me, and there's like miles of wall. Like, how are we going to implement this? So he's thinking through all of that. It's a great lesson for leaders that there's a point where we need to kind of evaluate and think and process and plan before we go public. Now, he went public with Artaxerxes, so he's in, but he hasn't told anybody else in terms of the big scope of people. He's about to, but he's formulating a plan at this point. And that's always wise, obviously, before you bite off more than you can chew or undertake something that you can't finish, okay? 14, I passed to the king's fountain gate, or rather to the fountain gate and the king's pool. There was no place for my mount to pass. Literally, it's so bad, he can't even bring his donkey or his horse through there. So he's got to get off and walk. Verse 16, the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I told any of the Jews, the priests, the nobles, and the officials, or the rest who had done the work. So we find out here, Nehemiah is going to rally a group of people to do the work, but he's told nobody what he's doing. Now, why else would you not want to inform folks? Why would Nehemiah be hesitant to say, man, here's what I'm going to do? It's dangerous. What do you think their response is going to be? Man, you're a nut job. Really? Like, they're going to think he's crazy. It's one of the things you need to remember about vision. Vision has holes in it, right? The big picture, like, oh, we should do this. Man, that's not difficult. The why, that's not as hard. The how it's going to get done, that's difficult. So immediately, Nehemiah, how are you going to do this? Where are you going to get the men? Where are you going to get the funding? Have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? So many big picture visions from God die at that level. People go, man, I would love to see this happen. Man, this grandiose 30,000 foot dream and vision from God. This would be so cool if we could just. And then all of a sudden people start going, well, how are you going to do that? How are you going to raise the money? You're never going to be able to raise $95,000 in a year, Mike. That's impossible. You can't do that. Oh, gosh, you're right. Man, that's a lot of money. I don't know anybody with $95,000 that they don't need, right, that wants to give it to me. Or how are we going to do it? How are we going to meet with, you know? And you start thinking about all these critiques, and so many people just back away from their vision and go, you know what? They're right. It's too hard. I don't know how. Be careful with that. Nehemiah is protective of who he shares his vision with early on to make sure that nobody's shooting holes in it. And when he's ready, then he's going to go public. And he doesn't even have it all figured out. He's going to have to continue during the process to kind of reevaluate and think through that. Now in 17, here's where he goes all in with the people. This is fantastic. I want you to notice this. Two verses, and this is some of the best leadership lessons here on how you communicate and cast vision. 17. By the way, he's speaking to the priests, the Jews, the nobles, and the officials, the people that are going to do the work. This is his audience in verse 17.
Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the walls of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. I told them of the hand of my God, and he had been upon me for good, and also for the words that the king had spoken to me.
All right, stop right there. Now I want you to notice, this is Nehemiah casting his vision, and there's four components of this that are fantastic that you need to be aware of, okay? Is any of you are thinking about launching anything or dreaming about stuff, okay? Every vision, every plan should have these four elements in it. A problem, solution, a why, and a why now. And Nehemiah is going to walk through those, okay? Look at verse 17. You see the bad situation that we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates have been burned with fire. Now, that's pretty obvious information, yes? Like, look, 150 years, nothing's changed. The gates, the wall have been in this condition. But he's identifying the what? The problem. This is an issue, gang. Maybe no one else thought that was a problem. But Nehemiah says, listen, this is an issue. This is unacceptable. And the fact that nobody has done anything about it for 150 years is an embarrassment, right? The city's in ruins. The people are in an awful condition. Nehemiah is calling them up saying, guys, you have learned to live in mediocrity, and you have been okay with this. This is not okay. And he's just doing something that everyone else could plainly see with their eyes, but he's creating within them a desire, or he's bringing an issue to the forefront and saying, listen, you may have been okay with this. This is not okay. God is not okay with this, right? It's not anything that they couldn't see for themselves, but Nehemiah is the first person to say, on my watch, this is not going to go down like that, okay? So he starts with the problem. Obvious to everybody, but it engages the mind. You see the problem. You see the situation that we were in. Now, here's the solution, okay? Every good problem, he's not a whiner. He's not barking. He's just not, oh, gosh, this is awful. He's going to give a solution. Keep rolling in after that piece, Buck. Its gates have been burned with fire,
And they said, let us...
No, go back to 17. I'm sorry, I'll read it. No more mind reading. He says, come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. So what is his plan? We're going to rebuild it. Who's going to rebuild it? Me? No. We're going to do this together. You live here. You're in the land. I'm here to help. I've got some vision, but we're all in together. This is the solution to the problem, right? It's very simple. It's not rocket science, but this is what Nehemiah sees. A problem, a solution. Now, here's a powerful part as well. Beginning of verse, or end of verse rather, 17, okay? Here's the why, that we may no longer be a reproach. How does God view this current situation of Jerusalem and the Jews that are there? What does it mean to be a reproach? In the eyes of God, what is he saying? This is an embarrassment, gang. This should not be the case. He calls it what it is. And no one has had the courage to say, guys, this is not okay. There's a problem, and it's not just a problem of rocks and a wall. This is a problem with God. He is disappointed. He is embarrassed that we would be living here and nobody would say, this is an issue, okay? Problem, solution, the why, and he's going to tell them now why they have to act today, why there is urgency. Look at this, 18. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me and about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Why would he tell them about his backstory, about God's hand in his life and in what King Artaxerxes had said? Yeah, credibility and, like, listen, man, I've been praying. God opened a door. Here's what happened. I met this guy that came in from Jerusalem in chapter 1. He told me about the condition of the wall. I prayed like mad. Here I am. And then I went to the crazy nut job King Artaxerxes, and I said this to him. I was bold. I was honest. And can you believe he gave me leave to go? He gives me a 13-month, you know, maternity leave, or 13-year maternity leave, right, to go rebuild the wall. Who does that? He gave me 13 years off, and then he wrote me a blank check. Here it is. We've got the money. We have the provisions. Let's go right now, okay? Problem, solution, why, and why now? As you guys think through the things in your life that bug you, you need to be able to put shoe leather on every one of those. And you need to be able to articulate, like Nehemiah, in two verses, how that's going to unfold. What is the issue that's plaguing your heart? How are you going to do something about it? Why does it matter to God? And why does it matter to others? And then why is it essential that something be done about it now? Okay? It may be like Nehemiah, where it's not rocket science. It's just an issue that we look at every day. And so many of the great visions and great things that people accomplish are just like that. They're things that we go, oh, how did I not see that? That's obvious. It may be a company that gets started where someone sees an issue and says, man, that's ridiculous. I was on Facebook the other day and saw a guy that basically made adjustable size shoes. Did you see this? Overseas. He made sandals to where kids can like expand the size of their shoes because they give them shoes to wear and then they outgrow them and then they don't have shoes again. He's like, well, why don't we make adjustable shoes? Duh. Like, that's brilliant. But nobody thought of it, right? Feet grow. How come shoes don't grow? He figured it out. And now he's got a company overseas selling shoes to kids that need shoes. It's brilliant, right? But it's an obvious thing, right? So as you think through your world, those are the components that you must have. You must be able to articulate those in a way that's compelling and simple and clear to people around you. Now, why must these people buy into what Nehemiah is saying? He can't do this alone, okay? Chapter 3 is a list of people that help in the deal. If they don't say, Nehemiah, you're right. This is a reproach. This is a problem. I'm going to sacrifice my time and my money and my job and time with my family, and I'm going to help you rebuild. If they don't go all in with him, he's done. He can't do this on his own. So he has got to be able to communicate this in a way where the people go, absolutely, okay? And sure enough, they do, right? 19 and following, our old friends Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah, they now mocked Nehemiah and the rest of the Jews, despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? King of who? Persia, right? So they accuse them, are now going to begin to discourage their building. Nehemiah's answer to them is in verse 20.
So I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem.
You're going to see several times Nehemiah chooses to answer the critics, and there's several times that he just says, I'm going to keep my mouth shut right now. And he uses great wisdom on how to address that. They immediately step up and discredit his work, and Nehemiah answers back and says, no, this is from our God. This is the hand of my God. We're about this work, and you will have no portion and no right in Israel. Let's be clear. We're drawing a line in the sand. You are not for what we're doing. So when we complete this work, and then you want to change teams and say that, oh, wait a second, I want to be over here because you accomplished the work, Nehemiah says, no, you've communicated very early on. You're not on our team. That's fine, but we're going to do the work without you, and that's just fine with Nehemiah. Okay. Now, chapter 3 is an odd chapter, and literally, it's just a list of people. But as you think about all great visions, this is what they take. The most important asset anybody has that's going to accomplish any great work of God is the people that are going to put their hand to the plow and work. And you see just a hodgepodge list of people that are mentioned. You get in verse 1 of chapter 3, a high priest. You get in verse 5, Tekoites, they made repairs. Nobles that are mentioned in verse 5, these would have been wealthy people. In verse 7, you get Gibeonites. Verse 8, Nehemiah has a goldsmith and a perfumer working next to each other. Do you think those two guys, their day in, day out jobs looked a little bit different, right? A goldsmith who's probably some hardened guy that's working with gold and, you know, like you can just kind of get this idea. He's like in a foundry and sweaty and nasty, and then you get a perfumer. Probably not that, right? So he's got different people from different backgrounds able to work together for the common good. Verse 9, this guy rallies half the district of Jerusalem. Verse 12, Shalom brings his daughters to come work with him, right? So this guy rallies a bunch of his family to come help. 17, Levites are out there. Man, they're hucking stones and building a wall alongside of them. 20, you get guys like this that are awesome. Baruch, the son of Zabi, zealously repaired another section. So the guy finishes his section of wall early. And he's like, give me more, right? He puts him on another section of wall. So all of it, right, is this. Now, I want you to notice, this is brilliant on Nehemiah's part. Look at the end of verse 21. You'll see this repeated throughout. This guy repairs the section as far as the end of his house. End of verse 23, beside his house. 28, in front of his house. So Nehemiah takes these people that said, man, we want to build, and where does he put them in terms of where, what section of the wall they're building? The piece right in front of their house. Now, why would that be important? Do you want that section of wall to be strong? Do you want that to be like built well and not shoddy and not, we don't have enough mortar, don't worry about it. Just stack the stones together, no one will know. He's brilliant, right, in the way he does this. He orchestrates people to make sure that they're in the right spot, and he makes them build the section of wall that's in front of their house because they care about the section of wall in front of their house, right? So chapter 3 is just one of those chapters where you go, not only does Nehemiah have the ability to see a vision and to know what God wants him to do, he's a people guy. He has the ability to rally men and women to the task, and they go, yes, we're in. Yeah, Zach. I don't think so. This is probably another dude. I haven't looked that up, Zach, but I do not think so. We're too far back or too far forward in history for that to be connected. So probably another Uriah. Okay. So chapter 3 is all about people. This is like Romans 16. It's all the people that Paul ministered to, and he leaves us off in Romans with just a gigantic list of people because people matter to the task. Okay, now, chapter 4, we're going to see now the work continued and the work attacked. 4 verse 1, our old boy Sanballat.
Now it came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. He spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, "What are these people here doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones?"
I mean, just you hear the mocking in his voice, right? He's a powerful guy. He's got nobles around him, and they're just looking down their nose. Can you rebuild it in a day? Are you going to be able to offer sacrifices later, right? This is a weak sauce effort. It's completely – are you really going to be able to unturn these stones and rebuild this wall? There's no way, Nehemiah. He's just mocking him, right? You're not going to be able to do this, discouraging his vision in every part of – launching a vision and implementing a vision has this in it. So as you guys think through what God's going to call you to do, it is not rose petal paths of like, this is so easy and there's no hard days. Most days are hard. And most days are like this where you're fighting people that say, man, just honestly, get out of the way. Let me do what I want to do. Let me do what God's called me to do. But there are going to be people like this that mock you, that laugh at you, that think what you're doing is insignificant and stupid and not worth your time and all these other people's time that you've now drug into this thing. Those guys exist and they'll continue to exist. Disregard them as Nehemiah did. Okay. He prays in verse 4. Listen to this. "Hear, O God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their heads and give them up for plunder in a land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity." This sounds like David, right? "Smash their teeth," like David prayed at one point of his enemies. "And let not their sin be blotted out before you, for they have demoralized the builders," right? Don't forgive them, right? Don't forgive their sin. Don't listen to their prayers. What have their simple words done to the atmosphere of the building at this point? They've crushed everybody. Just their words, and all these people are like, oh, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe this is a waste of time. Maybe this isn't a worthwhile endeavor. So Nehemiah's got to re-rally these people, breathe life in them, say, man, go, we can do this. So he's got to step up yet again, okay? Verse 6, it says, "So we built the wall. The whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." So even in the midst of this, they now have built half the wall all the way around. It's all now connected. Each person's house is connected to the person's house next to it, and they built it to half its height. So they're making progress, and their opposition is increasing because they're seeing them make progress. This isn't just a pie in the sky. They're actually putting their minds to work, and these people, man, they're working. They're getting after it. So amazing. Okay. Now, opposition's going to increase. Verse 7, they grab another dude. You get Sanballat, Tobiah. The Arabs mentioned in verse 7, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, all these people now, Sanballat and Tobiah rally. They're very angry about the fact that this wall is being built. Verse 8 now, they say, hey, we're going to come fight against you because now our words aren't enough. We're going to go to blows over this thing because we are not happy with this. Verse 9, Nehemiah's response. I love this about Nehemiah. You ever heard that old Civil War term, keep your powder dry? The idea is, man, you be ready to fight. Don't let that powder in your musket get wet because it's useless. Nehemiah prays, and then what does he do? He sets up, like, defenses, right? He's not just, like, praying on a shovel, leaning for a, praying for a hole, or leaning on a shovel, praying for a hole. He says, man, God, you've given the ability? Great. In one hand, you got a shovel. In the other hand, you got an axe. You know, we're going to use them both accordingly today, right? So get ready to work and then get ready to fight if we got to fight. But that's what we're going to do. Okay, so he doesn't even answer him this time. He just says, man, we're going to pray and we're going to trust God. These guys get cocky and arrogant. Look at verse 11.
Our enemy said they will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work.
Man, you've got to be pretty committed to this work at this point to stay involved. I mean, what do you think the people are doing at this point? That God in them, like, oh, yeah, we'll help you build. That's nice. All right. I don't have anything to do on a Tuesday anyway, so sure. Like, whoa, this isn't worth my life. I'm not going to die over this. I'm not going to get, you know, an axe because this guy's mad. See ya. Like, have fun, Nehemiah. He's got to rally people in a difficult day. There's not a big reward at the end of this. I mean, he's having to have people commit their lives. They're going to have to defend this place. It's going to get harder. So you see the type of opposition that Nehemiah is dealing with. Boy, this is part and parcel to the leadership process, to the visioneering process, and Nehemiah is able to push through it, okay? Verse 13, he's wise in how he implements this. He stations men at the lowest parts of the wall, all the exposed places that they would have had while they were building. And then he says in verse 14, this is great. He recognizes where the people are at after this. Look at that, 14.
When I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and their houses.
So what does he see in their faces and in their attitudes immediately? Fear. I mean, he recognizes, man, y'all are scared. I'm scared too, right? Don't be afraid. We're going to trust God. He's going to take care of this. Fight for your sons. Fight for your daughter. I mean, he raises the bar. This isn't just about a wall, gang. This is about your family. It's your sons and your daughters. Do you see how he continues to lift their eyes to the greater thing? Man, if this was just about rocks and mortar and bricks, that's a pretty lame vision. Agreed? Right? He's saying, no. This is about Jerusalem and God's place and what God's doing here and our families and the foothold that we're going to have back in the land. And he's raising them up to see the greatness that's involved. Okay. Verse 15, it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us that God had frustrated their plan. They all returned to the wall east of their work. They continued to get after it. Verse 17, those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried the burdens took their load with one hand doing the work and the other holding a weapon. I mean, you know it's serious when that's how you have to work, right? A weapon in one hand and your trowel in the other. This is serious. And they realize, man, we got to be all in to commit to this. But these folks were willing to take the next step with Nehemiah. He stations nobles and officials all along the wall. 21, we carried out the work, half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared, meaning now we've got a night watch. So not only do we have to do the work during the day with a spear in our hand and a trowel in the other, but at night, we've got to have a night watch where people are literally protecting the city from invaders at night. Like, you're losing sleep over this now. This is insane, the level of difficulty and opposition that they're getting for rebuilding a wall. It's like, really, guys? That's what it is, right? 23, listen to the conclusion of this chapter. So everywhere they go, with a weapon, 22, we find out they sleep in Jerusalem. Like, they don't even go home at night anymore. Bring your cot, bring your sleeping bag. We're sleeping on the job site, and we're going to protect this place day and night because that's what it's going to take to finish it. Do you think Nehemiah understood all this when he started building a wall? Like, no, that's just part of the process of, okay, reevaluate. What is this going to take? Okay, fix this problem. Okay, what's next? I mean, that's part of a job as a visioneer is figuring out, man, how do I change these things? How do we adjust mid-course? This is now the current reality. This is not the reality we were in yesterday. Well, guess what? Now we have opposition. They want to kill us. Okay, let's pray and let's put up some defensive forces. Okay, now they're going to attack us at night. Okay, which group wants the first watch? All right, y'all protect the wall while we sleep, and then we're going to switch midway through. I mean, he's doing a great job of orchestrating this grand plan of God's and is pushing through and seeing this thing done. Okay, now, chapter 5 is the only chapter where we do not see work done. External opposition has not been an issue, but we're going to find out internal problems are what are ultimately going to stop the building of the wall. It's the only place in the book of Nehemiah where we see the work on the wall stopped, and we'll find out why here in a second. Pick up in 5, verse 1.
Sons for those who said we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses to get grain because of the famine.
All right, so apparently times are difficult. There's a famine in the land. These people are working hard on this wall. They're not getting compensated for their work. They're just doing it because it's the right thing to do. And what's happening? Man, I'm running out of money. I'm running out of food. So what are they doing in verse 2? Our sons and our daughters are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may live. What are they having to do? They're having to sell their sons and daughters into slavery to get food. It is a bad, bad situation. They literally can't eat. They borrowed money in verse 4. They're completely maxed out on their credit cards. It's just gotten worse and worse and worse. Verse 5, now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children, yet behold, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters are forced into bondage already, and we are helpless because of our fields and our vineyards belong to others. We've mortgaged our fields, we've mortgaged everything we have, and as a last resort, we're having to say, yeah, my kid will be your indentured servant in exchange for food for them and food for me. I mean, that's a bad day. Would you agree? Now, you have done the right thing. You're working for God's plan. You're busting it. You see the higher vision, and what's happening in your life? Misery, right? While all the evil people, the Sanballats and the Tobias and those guys, what's happening to them? Opposition, they're getting blessed, they're buying your kids, they're giving you money, they're using you, and not just within the folks from the outside, but we find out it's also Jews exacting usury over other Jews, and we'll find out this is what blows Nehemiah's top. He gets super angry, okay? Verse 6, he said, I was very angry when I heard their outcry in these words. And then in verse 7, it says, I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles. I love that. It's another Huck Finn moment, right? I consulted with myself. I calmed down. I didn't burst out in anger. I didn't just vent. I relaxed. And then I said to the nobles, calmly, this is an issue. We have a problem. You that are in the upper crust of society and that have the means, I have a bone to pick with you. And here's the bone, verse 7. What does that mean? Usury or interest? So they're loaning each other money and means, but what are the Jews doing to other Jews? What are they collecting in this process? Interest, which was forbidden in the law, okay? If I'm having a hard day and I come to Allison and say, listen, I need $100 till payday, Allison can say, man, because you're a fellow Jew, here's $100, but I can't give her 120 in return. She's not allowed to do that. If out of the goodness of her heart she wants to loan me money, that's great, and I'm thankful, but no interest can be collected between Jews, okay? So they were exacting usury. They were collecting interest, and Nehemiah loses his mind over this because their situation is already horrible, and you're trying to benefit from their horrible situation. How dare you, right? So he literally gets floored, right? I said to them, verse 8, we, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who are sold in to the nations. So Nehemiah says, listen, we, meaning myself and others, have already redeemed other Jews that have been sold into slavery. We've done this already, okay? We have leveraged our own bank accounts in order to buy back Jews that were sold into slavery, okay, to other nations. Now you, fellow Jews, are putting your fellow Jew into slavery as a result of this and leveraging that for your good and making them their desperate situation even worse. Now, would you even sell your brothers, he says in verse 8, that they would be sold to us? They were silent and could not find a word to say. So Nehemiah literally gets in their face, thumps their chest, and says, this is what I have done. And the reason that they are silent is verse 14 and following. Okay, I talked about with David, the number one thing that he lost in the midst of his rule in the kingdom and what made it all go downhill. What was that thing that was the most crucial thing that you have as a leader? Moral authority. David lost it, okay, with Bathsheba, with Uriah, with Absalom, and the way he handled that. He lost his moral authority. He lost his ability to say, I have handled myself appropriately, okay? And the reason that these guys have no recourse in their actions is because of 14 and following. I want you to listen to what Nehemiah says. As the governor of Jerusalem, that was his appointed role by Artaxerxes, he had special privileges that were granted to him. Okay? This is what he says about those privileges in 14 and following. Jeremiah, read that.
Moreover, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, the 20th year, the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, for 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance.
So what does he say? I had an allowance of food that was given to me. By whom? Where would he get his food allowance from? Not just the Persia, but from the people. They would give a portion of their food to Nehemiah's table so they could eat. The crops, all the stuff that they grew, you don't bring food in from 900 miles away and have fresh fruit. You grow what you grow in the land, and they would give a portion of that. He says, I didn't do that. Why would I do that? Okay, keep going.
But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine besides 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants domineered the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God.
Did I have the right to do so? You better believe I did. I'm the governor of the land. Did I? No. Why? Because I care about the people. They matter to me. So I'm not going to make their bad situation worse in the time of a famine and take food from them. I had that right. I laid my rights aside for the sake of the people. That, friends, is servant leadership at its finest. I put myself below them and I serve them. I also applied myself to the work on this wall. I did not buy any of the land, and all my servants were gathered there before me. He goes on in 16, 17, and 18, and continues just to say, I have the moral authority to lead. I've been a servant. I've done nothing wrong. I am above reproach in every way. Okay. End of verse 18, I did not demand the governor's food allowance because the servitude was heavy on this people. So he just tells them, this is how I live my life, plain in the open. Now, what do you guys say to your usury over this people? And they're silent. They have no response to Nehemiah. Why is that? Why would these people who Nehemiah just accused of this cause not have any recourse? Not say, well, but, you know, Nehemiah, you did the same. Oh, really? No, I didn't. I had the right to, but I didn't. So Nehemiah basically just clowns them, makes them confess their sin. Verse 12, this is their answer.
We're going backwards.
I love you guys. What he asked them to do in verse 11 is, listen, give everything back, okay? The moral authority part comes later, is his explanation, but that's the why. So he says, this is my moral authority. What are y'all going to do about it? Give everything back. And they say, okay, you're right. So he calls them to a standard. The reason he can call them to that righteous standard is what? Because he's living according to that same righteous standard. He doesn't see himself as above the people. That's a great leadership lesson for all of us that are in those positions. We may have rights that are granted to us. And there's times that we need to deny those rights. Not always, but at times deny those rights for the sake of the people. And Nehemiah sees this as one of those times where he says, man, this is bad form. For me to take from their table to feed myself in abundance while they are slaving away, that's not right.
Isn't famine a sign of judgment normally?
We don't. It's mentioned here probably because of the condition of the land that they've been in for 7 years. They've been in exile. I would imagine that God's, you know, mad at the people that are living there. There's judgment on the land. We've seen that before with 1 Kings 17, when the lions came in and ate people, right? And then the guy's like, hey, we should send in their priest and teach them all, you know, all these things. So we're seeing some issues, okay? So chapter 5 is all about the moral authority that Nehemiah has and has not lost. So he is a great, great leader, okay? When you get down to the nitty-gritties of his life, man, he is above board in everything, okay? So only chapter we see internal division causes a stoppage in the work of God. Nehemiah's got to stop focusing on the external and now focus on the internal. And he's got to fix this problem because it's a cancer and it's going to spread. And no one is going to get any work done or trust anybody after this is done if people are taking advantage of their brothers and sisters. That is wrong. It's just a famine.
Could
Could just be a famine. Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially today. So, yeah, it's a good word. It may be nothing. It may be God frustrated at the land. That theology is much more prevalent in the Old Testament. Be careful today with connecting sin or issues with sin. That is, yeah, just be careful with that. Investigate, look into your own life, but don't ever say, you know what, you got this issue. There's probably a sin issue in your life because God's smiting you with such and so. Okay, that's, you laugh at that, but boy, it's done so often, and it's embarrassing, and it's hurtful to people that are trying to walk with God, and it's bad theology at the core of it, okay? It's a misunderstanding of our God. All right, now, six, more issues, 6 verse 1. All right, so they send a message to Nehemiah. They're frustrated because Nehemiah has advanced this project further than they thought they would. They kick him a note and say, hey, come meet us, right? We want to talk. Let's have a truce, okay? Nehemiah realized, man, these guys are dirty. Something's going on. I'm not going to meet with them, okay? Verse 3, I love this. This is how Nehemiah sees the task at hand. I am doing a great work. I will not belittle myself to come down to you. God has called me to this great work. Have any of you ever laid brick before? It is some of the most miserable, backbreaking, difficult work you will ever do. This is not a great work, by the way, in the ideas of like the echelons of society, right? This is a hard blue-collar job. Not many people can do it because it is difficult. So Nehemiah has the ability to see, man, this is a great work. And it may be meaningless in the eyes of people, but this is what God has called me to. Andy Stanley taught this, and he shares the story in a book called Visioneering. Basically, he wrote a book on Nehemiah called Visioneering. So if you like the book, read Stanley's book. It's fantastic. And he shares the story of a stay-at-home mom, I think it was, that was brilliant, right, and was raising her kids and got called to go back into the workforce. And her answer to going to be in the upper crust of society and get paid really well in the workforce was, I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. She saw her role as a stay-at-home mom is valuable. I am discipling the next generation. I am pouring into my kids. This is a great work of God. Now, society may think I'm a goofball and wasting my degrees and wasting my time and my talents. I'm just kind of shoving them aside. If you really want to be meaningful, come make $100,000 a year and come do this job. And she said, you got it all wrong. This is what matters. And she had the ability to see investing in the next generation and being a wife and a mom was a higher calling than anything else she could put her mind to. Okay. Not that working for women is bad, and that's not a bad thing. There's certainly a time and a place for that. But she saw her priorities at that time saying, we have the means and the ability to invest in my kids, and we're going to do it. If that means we need to pinch a little bit, live in a smaller house, drive a junkier car, no problem. This is what we're going to be about, okay? And it's one of those stories that stuck with me forever, especially having a wife that is a stay-at-home mom that does a great job, gets very few accolades. Nobody's given her a pay raise. Nobody knows the hard work that she puts in, the hours that she dedicates in our home. And as a result, our kids are different for it. We have phenomenal kids because of the work of my wife in our home. So remember that as you guys are called to things that may feel meaningless in the eyes of society, in God's eyes, they could be so noble. And you've got to have the ability to say, you have it wrong. This is a great work. Okay. So just a story that's always stuck with me. So he says, no, they ask verse 5 4 times. And 4 times Nehemiah sends a note and says, no, I'm working. This is important. I'm not going to come deal with you. Okay. So again, sometimes Nehemiah says, okay, and speaks back. Other times he just prays. Other times he says a note and says, no, I'm busy, right? Call me later. But he doesn't deal with them. Okay. Now in 5 and following, they try to slander Nehemiah. They go into more and more degrees, more difficult degrees of trying to get this stoppage of the wall. Okay. He says in verse 6, it's reported among the nations that Geshem says, you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you're rebuilding the wall, you are to be their king according to the reports. So what do they accuse Nehemiah of now? Your intentions of rebuilding the wall really aren't that pure, Nehemiah, are they? What is your ultimate intention? You're going to rebel against Artaxerxes, and you're going to what? You're going to be the king. That was the rumor on the street, so that's what they were accusing him of. Now, what did Nehemiah go like fisticuffs with last chapter about the same issue, right? You're trying to lord yourself over them. You're trying to take what, you know, as a governor and advance your career, whatever. Nehemiah says, no, I'm not. And they accuse him of the exact thing that he is most sensitive about. Like, I'm not trying to put myself over this people. I am with this people. I'm a servant to this people. That is not my intention. But they try to discredit him, and he won't have anything with it, okay? He sends a message to them in verse 8 and says, such things are you are saying have not been done. You are inventing them in your own mind. So he defends his character and says, man, that is not the case. You're inventing these things. All of you were trying to frighten us, thinking that they will become discouraged with the work and it will not be done. So he realizes their ultimate plan is to try to find any angle they can to get the work on the wall to stop, and it's not going to work. He's not going to cave to that. Love his attitude, okay? Verse 10, they take it to now the highest degree. They try to disqualify Nehemiah morally. Watch what they do in verse 10.
When I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, son of Mehetabel, who was confined at home, he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are going to kill you, and they are going to kill you at night.
So he now has death threats because of a rebuilding of the wall. Like, really, gang? We're building a wall, and they're going to kill you over the rebuilding of the wall. At least that's what he's told. And the solution to this problem is what? What does this guy who's an imposter say to Nehemiah? What should we do to protect you? Let's go to the temple, shut the doors, and hide. Now, bells and whistles should be going off. Nehemiah is a Jew. He's a normal dude. But can he go into the temple? No. He's not a priest, and he realizes, man, you're trying to frame me. Like, something's going on. This is not right. Now, boy, you talk about commitment to the cause when you get death threats, and he says, man, we're going to push through. Verse 11.
But I said, should a man like me flee? And could one as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in.
Like, man, like, I'm not going to run from these guys. If they want to bring it, bring it. We'll take it head on. I mean, this guy's got... he's bold. He is not scared. And then he says, man, can I go into the temple, one such as me? No, I don't have the right to. I'm not a Levite. I'm not a priest. I can't go into where you're saying I should go in and shut the doors. They're trying to discredit him. And they're trying to catch him inside the temple to say, see, you think you're a priest. You think you're a king. And discredit his ministry. And then everybody goes home and they win. Okay. Then I perceived that surely God had not sent him. He has the ability to discern, this is not from the hand of God. This is wrong. In the moment, he goes, this smells fishy. Something about this is wrong, and he's able to see it. He was hired for a reason. I might become frightened, he says in verse 13, but it's not going down that way. You are not going to disqualify me. Verse 14, remember, oh my God, Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these words of theirs. And he says, man, you strengthened me in my day of distress. I am not doing this. So that is the last straw with these guys. Verse 15, here's the hoorah.
So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month Elul.
Yep.
In 52 days.
52 days. Just under 2 months. They rebuild this whole wall. Now, I don't know how long an undertaking like this is supposed to take, but boy, that seems fast. A lot of people doing the work together with a great leader at their side. Nehemiah does a great job. Okay, so phenomenal story of how this thing was completed. Now, we still are only halfway through the book. The wall's done, and now we got to see what else happens. Now, 16, watch what happens to opposition immediately.
When all our enemies heard of it, all the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem. For they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God.
My Bible says they lost their confidence. It literally means fell much in their eyes. Like the wind was just taken out of their sails. They realized that they got clowned. And God was about this. Nehemiah was a part of it. The workers put their hand to the task. And all of a sudden, their voices are silenced. The work's done. And you can do nothing at this point. Now, they're still going to try to disrespect him and push on stuff. But they are ultimately put to shame. Okay. Verse 17, Allison, keep going there.
Verse and Tobiah's letters came to them.
So we'll hear more about this guy in a little bit, what happens to Tobiah. He's a chump. Nehemiah is going to take a leave from being governor for 13 years, go back to Persia, and this guy is going to become a major player in the land. He's not done. He's just waiting for an opportunity. Okay. 7 verse 2, Nehemiah now puts guys in charge. Okay, the wall is built, and now he's got to put people in charge of the work in Jerusalem. He puts Hanani, my brother, in charge of Jerusalem. He was a faithful man who feared God more than many. What a great thing to be said about you. A faithful man who fears God more than many. And that is what got this guy put in a significant spot of leadership. Okay, verse 3. We've got issues now going on. The wall's built, but nobody wants to live in the city. They literally have to tithe people to come live into the city. It's there and it's built, but it's still very much in ruins. Houses aren't completely rebuilt. Nobody wants to live there at this point. So they literally are taking, in verse 7, Zerubbabel, Joshua or Yeshua, the high priest that we saw earlier in Ezra, and all these people, and they're numbering them, and they're just putting them into city to make sure it's safe and that people are living there. So it's still, though it's been rebuilt, people aren't super excited about it, okay? So chapter 8, okay, that's the list of the people in 7, yeah.
The wall took 52 days to build. Where are we in the 13 years?
That was at the beginning. Now he's going to stay for 13 years to kind of set up shop, okay, and establish the presence in Jerusalem. So he is there from, 444 B.C., to 432. Is that right? Yeah. Okay, so that's a 12-year period, but we're at the beginning of that. So we just finished the wall, and now we're going to begin to, so the beginning of his reign as governor. Okay, so the part that we saw, by the way, in chapter 6, he's reflecting a little bit on his years as governor, never taking a food allowance, even in the midst of, after rebuilding the wall, he's speaking into his entire tenure as governor, how he never took advantage of the people during the building of the wall, after the building of the wall, living in the town. He never did any of that. Okay. Now 8 verse 1 is a great leadership lesson for all of us. Okay. Oh, we get a boogie. There's a time to lead from the front and there's a time to lead from the back. Okay. Nehemiah realizes, man, we've got to continue to rebuild these people. There's a guy around here that can do this job much better than me. His name is Ezra. And he says, Ezra, you need the props. And he says, you need to go stand in front of the podium and you need to teach the people the word of God. And Nehemiah is fine taking a back seat and realizing when his job is done to a degree, he exalts this guy. Ezra comes in, opens the book of the law and teaches the people. Everybody that's there, and they lose their minds. Verse 6. Lifting up their hands, they bowed low, worshiped their God, their faces to the ground. The Levites would come around during the midst of Ezra preaching the message. They would have like small group leaders in like the sanctuary explaining what Ezra was saying if they were confused. So they're teaching them the law. End of verse 9, these people are wrecked because they realize, oh gosh, we've been living in captivity for 70 years. We haven't been obeying any of this. They all start weeping and Nehemiah says, whoa, time out. Today's a party. We're here to celebrate, right? We need to repent, but we're not going to whip ourselves. Like, we're going to celebrate. Verse 12, we're going to have a festival, the Feast of Booths, of Tabernacles. It was during that time. So they celebrate, and Nehemiah gives Ezra the front leadership position. He read from the book of the law. Look at the verse, last verse of chapter 8. 17. There was great rejoicing. 18, he read from the book of the law. From the first day to the last day, they were celebrated the feast 7 days. So they celebrate the Feast of Booths where they camp out in the wilderness, celebrate the Passover and God providing for the people post-Passover in the wilderness. Phenomenal, phenomenal deal, okay? Booths or tabernacles. Really, they would set up. No, not that. No. Though there was probably wine. Yes. Booths, B-O-O-T-H-S, okay? There you go, okay? 9, chapter 9, the people are still, after hearing the law, they're wrecked, they celebrate, but they repent, they're getting their lives right, okay? 9, you kind of see the structure of it. This is a prayer that the people offer. This is their proclamation to God. It's a beautiful chapter, a review, Old Testament history, like they always do, but giving props to God, all that they have done, all the way up to chapter 9, verse 36 is the current situation. They talk about being slaves today because of disobedience. The land which you gave to our fathers to eat of this bounty, behold, we are slaves in it because of our disobedience. So they're trying to turn their lives around, trying to get things right once again and make repentance and living with God the right thing. Okay? So I know we're boogieing, but this is kind of the big picture. Okay? Chapter 10, verse 1, we see Nehemiah's official title here, Nehemiah the governor. Okay, so he's going to be, from this point forward, 13 years in the land, and he's going to be there to govern Jerusalem. That's his job, okay? I want you to notice three things that he makes these people commit to. In verses 28 and following, he gets all the people together after this gigantic party and says, hey, there are three things that we're not going to do, okay? 30, this is the first one.
We will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land or take their daughters for ourselves.
Okay. First thing we're not going to do. No. What do we call that? Intermarriage. We're not going to marry the pagan peoples again. Not because we don't like the pagan peoples or they're bad, but why? What's the issue? Idolatry. Okay. Verse 31. As for the people of the land who bring wares and grain on the Sabbath day, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or the holy day. We will forego the crops on the seventh year in the exaction of every debt. So what day of the week are we going to honor? The Sabbath, okay? Why? Why is that important to Nehemiah? No intermarriage, idolatry. We're going to honor the Sabbath so we don't have what? Idolatry. We're going to do this right, okay? Verse 34, likewise, we're going to cast lots for the supply of wood among the priests, the Levites, the people. Verse 37, we're also going to bring the first of our dough, our contributions, and we're going to tithe to the priesthood. Why? Why must the priesthood be sustained? So we don't have idolatry. We're going to make sure that we set up some religious boundaries, that we worship on Sunday or Saturday for them, that we don't intermarry with pagan peoples to bring pagan gods in here. And we're going to tithe our paychecks to the support of the temple to make sure that the priests and the Levites have a job so that they can lead us in worship so that we don't have idolatry. We're done with idolatry. Okay, that's basically what Nehemiah is getting after. That's chapter 10. Okay, these are the things they commit to. Remember those. No intermarriage. No jacking with the Sabbath. Don't buy, sell, trade, anything. Okay, and we're going to support the priesthood. Okay. 11 verse 1, the leaders of the people in Jerusalem, the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, but the rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to the city. This is what we talked about prior. Literally, they've got the leaders in there, but the people are still living outside the city in kind of their temporary shelters. They cast lots, and you get a number of people that are mentioned here in chapter 11 that ultimately move into the city. They've got to populate it. They've got to make it safe, and so on and so forth. Okay, all the way through 12 verse 26, these are just a list of the people that ultimately come into Jerusalem and set up shop there and live. Okay? Go all the way to 12:27 and look what's happening now. Yep. What do they do, by the way, at the end of a great work of God? What do they stop and do? Celebrate. They pause and say, time out. We need to acknowledge this. We need an Ebenezer. We need to mark a moment. We need to have an altar. We need to remember what we've been through, and we need to celebrate. And Nehemiah, like, writes it into the plan. We're going to stop, and this is what we're going to do. And it is huge, okay? Priests and the Levites in verse 30 purified themselves. 31, I had one of the leaders of Judah come up on top of the wall. I appointed two great choirs, the first proceeding from the right, on top of the wall toward the refuse gate. He brings the choirs on top of the wall. This is basically a to Tobiah and Sanballat. They said earlier, as they were mocking Nehemiah, we skipped over it, but if a fox were to jump on the wall, it would fall down. And Nehemiah says, how about all the choirs get on top of the wall and we'll celebrate from up there? So he's saying, it's done. It's done right. It can support hundreds of people, and they celebrate. Fantastic. Okay, so Nehemiah's, he's reveling that just a little bit, I think, in a right, godly way, okay? Verse 36, end of verse 36, notice who's leading this.
Ezra the scribe went before them.
So who leads this whole thing? Ezra. Who did all the work? Who did all the organizing? Who cast the vision? Who Nehemiah, okay? Verse 38, where's Nehemiah?
Second choir proceeded to the left, while I followed them with half of the people on the wall.
Where's he? He's at the back with the people, just hanging out, right? Why? Because they matter to him. He doesn't care about the spotlight that day. He knows the photographer is in the Fresno Bee and ABC is going to be out there. He doesn't care. Let Ezra get the press. That's fine. I'm going to hang out in the back, talk to the people that did the work. We're going to share stories. We're going to laugh. We're going to celebrate, right? This is what makes a great leader. I don't care who gets the press, right? Ezra's the guy. This is his job. He is the spiritual leader. Let him do that. Man, that's great. And Ezra was fine to do it because that was his role. And Nehemiah goes to the back and celebrates with the people. And that's one of the things that makes Nehemiah, amongst others, a phenomenal leader. He doesn't care who gets the credit, okay? Verse 43, on that day, they offered sacrifices, rejoiced because God had given them great joy. So Nehemiah stops and says, man, we're going to throw a world-class celebration, and we're gonna party because of what God's done. Okay, so it's an amazing thing. So this is the end of probably his first year as governor of the land. This is how it starts, and it is a beautiful picture. Problem is, chapter 13. Okay, Nehemiah goes home for 13 years. Home being Persia, gets word that things are not so good 13 years later after he is no longer governor, and he says, King Artaxerxes, I need to go back. I've gotten word that things have gone awry in Jerusalem, and now you're about to see Nehemiah pull an Ezra. He's going to lose his mind, okay? Here's what's going on. So 13, he comes back. Verse 4, this is the condition that Nehemiah finds Jerusalem in 13 years later. Whoa. You got a priest who's related to who? Tobiah. Who was Tobiah? Tobiah was the guy that was trying to slander this whole thing. So more than likely, Elishab, the priest, gives his daughter into marriage to Tobiah. Watch what they do for this chump in verse 5. Where? He gets a room? Where? Where do you put grain offerings? In the temple. Are you kidding me? You have an apartment inside the temple of all people. Like, this is wrong to begin with, and you're going to put this chump in the temple? Nehemiah loses his mind. He says in verse 6, I wasn't there at the time. I came to Jerusalem in verse 7. I learned about it. This thing in verse 8 was displeasing. He says in verse 8, I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. He comes in and just evicts the guy. Just chucks his stuff over the wall. Get out, right? He is mad because the Sabbath isn't being honored. This guy's intermarrying with a pagan. Like, wow. This is exactly what I told you not to do when you, like, when I let. He's like, losing it, right? So, first of all, you got Tobiah in there. He evicts that guy. Verse 10, I discovered that the portions for the Levites had not been given. What else had they not done? Are they tithing to the people of God? No. So the worship system is broken down. So I reprimanded the officials of verse 11 and said, what the heck? Why have you not done this? Okay, so that's Mike Sladen version, okay? Verse 15, in those days I also saw in Judah that some were treading wine presses on the Sabbath, bringing in sacks of grain, loading them with donkeys. What else are they doing? Are they working on the Sabbath? Yes, Nehemiah said, do not do this, right? He said three things, and they screwed up all of them in 13 years when he's gone. He loses his mind. Verse 17, I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, what is this evil thing that you are doing by profaning the Sabbath? He goes ballistic, right? There's guys literally that are sleeping outside of the temple gates trying to get in to sell their goods. He says to them in verse 21, I warned them and said to them, why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do this again, I will use force. This is a warning. Next time, you're getting a fist in the teeth. Get out of here. I'm not screwing around. So Nehemiah is just not afraid to, like, his leadership goes to a different level, right? And I don't know what he means by use force, but I think it's clear that, like, I will have you physically removed from here if you try to do this again, okay? Verse 23, I found out that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Amnon, Moab. Are you kidding me? Are we here again? Nehemiah loses his mind. Verse 24, by the way, this is a great text on what happens with intermarriage.
24. And half their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they could not speak the language of Judah, but only the language of each people.
So when you put a Christian and a non-Christian together, who wins? Every time. Every time. And that's why Nehemiah says, we're not having this. We're not going to do this. I contended with them. Listen to this. Verse 25. I contended with them. I cursed them and struck some of them, pulled out their hair for them. By the way, pulling out a hair was a sign of repentance. So Nehemiah is saying, if you're not going to repent, I'm going to repent for you. I'm going to put on your sackcloth and ashes. I'm going to smash up your face. I'm going to pull out your hair. So at least you're going to look repentant. So he clearly tells them, man, you should be grieved by this. You shall not give your daughters to their sons nor take their daughters for your sons in marriage. This is not okay. So every edict that he had had the people covenant to 13 years later, every aspect had been broken. And this is what, this is Nehemiah's vision, right? This is his heart. This is his life's work. He goes back to be a cupbearer, but man, his heart is still in Jerusalem. He returns to see this and he's embarrassed. So he fixes this. Verse 30, I purified them from every foreign, everything foreign, and appointed duties for the priest and the Levites to his task. 31, I arranged for the supply of wood at the appointed times for the first fruits. In the last verse, the historical portion of the Old Testament, last sentence, read that into verse 31.
And I provided for the wood offering and appointed times and for the first fruits. Remember me.
Remember, God, what I have tried to do for you. Like he's just asking God, man, I've done everything I know how to do to set godliness and prosperity in this land, okay? So that's Nehemiah, great guy. Man, I can't wait to meet that guy and shake his hand in heaven. Neat dude. So one of my favorites, great book, all right? So there you go, gang. We've got a restored group of Jews with a temple, with a wall, with the restored people, thanks to Ezra, that are worshiping God for the next 400 years. And they are waiting now for the forerunner to come and to announce the Messiah that would ultimately arrive in our New Testament, okay? So, which you have studied plenty about. So, from this point on, now it's 400 years of silence until John the Baptist appears on the scene, okay? Cool?
Mike,
yeah.
Do we have a perspective on where Ezra was in this last period?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question. I would guess absent, given the situation.
He had been there and yeah. Everything he had fought against as well.
Yeah, I would assume he wasn't there because Ezra's not a slacker. So, yeah, I don't know. That's a great question, Dan. Okay. We done. Yes, ma'am. Visioneering by Andy Stanley. Visioneering. Like to engineer a vision. It is a phenomenal book. Okay, and it's basically a commentary on Nehemiah. If you've never heard Andy Stanley teach, by the way, it's worth your time. The guy's gifted. DTS grad, solid dude, leads a church out in Atlanta. So, a small church. I think there's like 40,000 people there. It's insane. So, bad. Yes, Jason, sorry. They fit within the time period that we covered, okay? So Jeremiah is a contemporary, along with Isaiah, of Hezekiah. So they wrote during his day. So all those plug into all the things you've read, okay? Make sense?
What do you think when it talks about the joy of the Lord in
Everybody's going, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. We want to talk about the test. Yes. Where you're coming out of left field? Is that in the text? Did I miss it? Do you know where it is, Jason? He's looking. Chapter 8, verse 10. That one. Got it. Man, I don't know. I would. I did not study that in great depth this morning. So. You're going to have to ask someone that's spiritual to read Psalms. It's there too. Test, are you guys ready? I'm sorry, Jason. I'm not trying to shut you down. All right. How much have you guys gotten from Shay and Jared? Give me a quick 30-second overview of what they've communicated. I have two ears. I can only hear one thing at a time, though. Okay. You are a dirty liar, as are you. Someone that's honest. You're out. You're out. He showed you the test?
That showed us the test.
He didn't show us the questions, but he said, I have the test.
He showed us from that distance, yeah. He showed us the test.
This one right here? Whoa! OMG! Okay, here's the deal. It's not tricky. It is thorough. So be aware of that, okay? There are 100 and, okay, which means 250, because one question has 9 answers, okay? So it's thorough. So you may be told, hey, there's 8 of these, name 4. Each one of those is a portion of one question, okay? So think through the proportionality of how much time we spend in stuff, okay? We spend a lot of time in Genesis, not a lot of time in Deuteronomy. I would study accordingly, okay? So be aware of that. When I've looked through a chart of 39 kings and said, hey, these are the important aspects. Don't worry about this dude and all these things. Don't worry about those things. Remember the things that I said were important, big picture stuff, okay? You need to know themes of books. You need to know big picture stuff, things of that nature, okay? It's not multiple choice. It is you and a Bible, and again, not your Bible that you brought to residency and have all your notes in. It's, what is the theme of Exodus? Go. There's not 3 choices. It's you know it or you don't know it, okay? So there are very few questions that have multiple guess, at least for the ones that I wrote, okay? Shay's questions tend to be harder. I'm just going to tell you that from previous tests, so just be aware of that, okay? Tell you what, you remember... We'll ask at the party, okay? So in 2 weeks, you guys tell me who was wrong, okay? And it will be Shay, I promise you, okay? Again, we're not trying to trick you guys, but it is, I mean, this is 9 months worth of stuff, and it's thorough, okay? So it's just, I want to give you guys an idea of what it is. Now, if you study, and you've listened in class, and you put in some time studying, I guarantee you you'll make an 85, okay? Unless you were asleep and not paying attention. Some of you that may qualify for it's not okay. So what do you guys want me to answer? Okay, you got me for 15 minutes. I'm not gonna read questions to you, but what types of questions do you guys have that will help clarify?
Have to know a lot of names of people?
Some that are important, yeah, but not nitty gritty like, you know, the third son of the sons of Zeruah. You know, that's not on there. Like, okay. But they're like major players in the story, yeah, you're gonna need to know those when they affected a big deal. Now there's some extra credit on there. There's some names in there that we'll drill down a little bit, but they're extra credit. But there are certainly some. If I've gone like crazy on a story and said this is the most important story in the history of existence of man, and there are a bunch of people you've never heard of, I'd probably write those down and know them. Okay, so do any of those stories come to mind that I lost my mind on? Yeah, I would probably know a guy or two in there. Mephibosheth, I'd probably know Mephibosheth. I like him. Okay. Zelophehad? No, don't worry about that. Leviticus 8 through 10. You guys remember that story? Who are those people? Aaron's sons. Bad offering. I like those guys. Okay. Those are the types of things. They may be more minor, but if you can't remember who David is or Solomon, boy, we got bigger issues, okay? So a lot on Genesis, okay? Again, we're heavier in terms of the folks that we've studied. I don't think those are on there. You do. What is my nickname? Oh, yeah. Right. Okay. The test goes in order, just FYI. So like when you're done with Genesis, you're done with Genesis, okay? So you'll start there and you'll keep moving through it so you can kind of breathe easy. So as you're thinking through, oh, I remember that story. I think we're like somewhere here. You guys have the freedom to look in your Bible, but just the test kind of goes, the Old Testament portion at least, that I wrote, goes in order, okay? You can take as much time as you want. There is a time limit, okay? So you need to judge accordingly how much time you want to spend, okay? We put a time limit on it because people spent 4.5 hours taking this test. It would spend 5 minutes digging in Scripture trying to find an answer, and our proctors about lost their mind, okay? So there's a time limit for a purpose. So if it's like, oh, oh, that's here. Oh, yeah, that guy, okay? That's right, but you're not supposed to spend 20 minutes going, I think it's somewhere in the Torah. Let me look at each page, right? Okay, don't do that. Yeah, Wayne.
When I take a written test, I try to answer, go through 3 or 4 pages and answer everything that's on my mind at the time, and then go back over it. Can I do that?
Totally. Say, can we skip that? I don't know that one offhand. Let's go back to it. So if you want to get through it, so then you know, I got 45 minutes left to answer the ones that I wasn't sure about, then you can judge it. Yeah, you can skip it. You can go through it however you want. Okay. Assuming your proctor lets you, so I'm assuming they will, but if they have a vengeance because they're mad at me because I gave them their test, they may say, no, Mike was mean to me, and I'm going to be mean to you, so take it. I doubt that's the case.
More just an oral interchange.
It's an oral test, okay? So you are, they're asking you questions, you've got your Bible, and you're answering them. So there will be a few where they'll show you the paper and say, here's 9 options, put these in the correct order, okay? Okay, so I'm looking through questions. I think we've covered pretty much everything. And if you guys are like, hey, as a group, man, we never covered that. We didn't talk about that in class. We can talk about that at the deal. So, again, this doesn't get you into heaven. In the grand scheme of things, this is a learning exercise for you. It's to cause you to remember the things that you've learned. Okay, so don't panic about it. But remember, this doesn't get you anything special. Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. Other than themes, what other things aren't in the pages?
Breakdowns of books.
Like a verbal charting.
Walk me through Genesis. Can you walk me through it?
Sovereign election.
Okay. Planks, then patriarchs. Can you walk me through all the planks? Okay, you should be able to. Okay. Can you walk me through the patriarchs? You better be able to. Okay. That's the big picture stuff I'm talking about, okay? Can you walk me through the book of Leviticus? Can you show me the movements in the book? You need to be able to do that, okay? Now, you don't need to tell me all the 9 different types of things you can offer during this specific sacrifice, but you better know chapters 1-7 of Leviticus are about offerings and sacrifices, right? So you need to know those things. 8-10 is a movement, 11-15, 16 is the climax, so on and so forth, okay? So... No.
Great.
No Song of Solomon. No Proverbs. Okay, those are just for you. So tuck those away. Don't study them if you don't want to. Okay. AOD, yes. Okay. Geography. Okay. You will be handed a blank map. Okay. And you will be required to label it. Okay. I don't need you to know where the city of Nob is. Okay. But if you can't find Jerusalem on the map, we got problems. Okay. If you don't know which is the Dead Sea and which is the Sea of Galilee, we have problems, okay? So, not super detailed, but you need to be able to look at a map of Israel and go, yep, okay, all right? Areas of geography within Israel that we talked about, okay? Where do the Philistines live? Coastal plains. Next to the coastal plains, the low hills called the Shephelah. And then we get into further east, where Jerusalem is. The Judah Mountains, and then after the Judah Mountains is the wilderness, Rift Valley, okay? I would know those, right? The rest of the stuff you'll get, okay?
You don't have to draw it, do you?
Nope. It will be drawn for you, okay?
Just draw like Jared.
Hot dog, bite taken out.
Jared's a mess. Okay? So... Anytime you want to before, yeah. I would contact, if you guys, this has probably been said 9 times, contact your folks now, set up your exam date so you aren't rushed at the end. Okay, do not show up to the graduation dinner not having taken your final, okay? Do not do that, okay? So, take it, Have it ready, okay?
Doesn't it have to be mailed into the Chukatis by that Monday or something? By
yes, yeah. So whatever those dates were. So just think through that. Make sure she has it. So I mean, if you want to spend $50 to overnight it, then more power to you. But, yeah, that's in that email.
When you talk about movement, is it according to you or how we saw the
what I taught you. Okay. Y'all are good. Okay. So that's it. They're going to mail the test, but you're going to bring. Do you guys all know about this? This was in the email that Patty sent out. Chad, will you show them? You're to bring that with you, okay? And some stamps, okay? You're going to mail your test to Patty so that she can grade it and get us the results, okay? So that is what you need. Read Patty's email, okay? She sent you all that information. I read it. Same email she sent you guys, okay? Okay, so there you go. Yeah. Now, if you want your test results at the party, then get it done before then, and we'll have them ready, okay? No, proctors don't grade it. Proctors take notes, but Patty grades it, okay? So it's some not, and we grade things on a – it just depends on how she looks at it. To make sure there's uniform grading, one person grades it, so – Yep. Hey, you said the theme was this. They said this. Patty, is that close enough? And some of the answers I'll say, hey, this date is fine. Somewhere in this neck of the woods, I want them to say something like this. Or sometimes I want them to say sovereign election and everything else is wrong. So there's room or there's wiggle room, okay? Yeah, Jesus will get you some questions right, I think. All right? Yes, Scott. Nothing else.
What kind of dates are we gonna need?
The ones I showed you? Yeah, Rachel. Yeah. 99% of the proctors want to help you do well on this test. Okay, so they're looking for, no, give me more. No, not that. Yes, this. Okay, more of that. You'll find out. This is going to be tough. Guys, have fun. You'll enjoy it. Okay. See you guys at the party.